Back to Radio Times. The Fossil Free Campaign is a student movement that began at a handful of colleges and universities and now has activists at several hundred campuses. They are targeting university endowments and putting pressure on boards to divest oil, coal, and gas stocks because of the impact of CO2 on the climate. It's been a bit of an uphill struggle. While a few universities have sold their fossil fuel stocks, many have not. For instance, at Harvard, a majority of students voted for divestment while the board said they favored education. So today in Radio Times, we want to explore this campaign and discuss some of the pros and cons of divestment. We'd like to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. And we begin our conversation with the first of three guests with Catherine Bagley. She's a reporter for Inside Climate News, covers the intersection of environmental science, politics, and policy with an emphasis on climate change. And Catherine Bagley, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
So where and how did this movement get started?
So it has its origins in an article that environmental writer Bill McKibben wrote in Rolling Stone. It appeared in the magazine last August. The article kind of dived into climate change's new math. It looks at kind of, you know, how much gigatons of CO2 that fossil fuel companies have in their reserves that we can't burn if we want to stay below the kind of 2 degrees Celsius threshold that climate scientists say is kind of the doomsday number. You know, after that, there'll be a series of tipping points that will hit any kind of irreversible impacts, such as the Greenland ice sheet. And so the divestment movement kind of came up from that math and kind of saying, okay, well, we can't burn all this carbon that we have, and we need to send a message to fossil fuel companies. Mm. And so let's pull the money that we have invested in them. And it's a strategy that was used previously. It was very successful in the 1980s to fight apartheid, and similar campaigns have been done against tobacco companies and also for Darfur.
Was Bill McKibben appealing to students, or was it that students were read what he wrote in Rolling Stone and organized themselves around this campaign?
So after Bill McKibben wrote the article, he went on a tour across the country, and I think it was about 30 cities, maybe more, in a very short period of time, and he traveled across the country in a bus, just going city to city and talking to audiences that were just packed with thousands of people that I think were all looking for a way to get involved in the climate fight, and this just really grabbed their attention. Bill's a really fascinating character, and he has an amazing ability to kind of get people to follow him. He's really engaging, and I think he's a great leader for this.
And do you know how many university college campuses have organized around this effort?
So far there are campaigns on over 300 campuses across the country, literally from coast to coast. There's also some campaigns in Canada. I think there's a few in Great Britain. But like you said, there's only a few places that have actually divested. So in a lot of these places, the campaigns are small, but they're growing.
And in terms of how to get the message across, what tactics or strategies are some of these students using?
So, you know, there's usually a core group of students on the campuses that are trying to interact with board of trustees, people managing the endowments, and they're trying to get in and have meetings with them and talk to the presidents of the schools and, you know, make their voices heard. They're also writing editorials in their college newspapers and also kind of local newspapers. And one of the tactics that we saw around graduation time was students actually wearing kind of green dots on their graduation gowns to signify that they wanted their schools to divest. And some schools have even tapped into their faculty and alumni. And I know at American University, for example, some of the alumni have said that they won't donate until the schools divest.
Mm. Have there been protests and rallies? I mean, I know that sounds very 1960s to ask that question. I'm showing my age here. But have there been protests and rallies in support of this divestment
There definitely have. And it's been kind of amazing to see, like, I guess, that older tactic come to life again this past year. There have been a lot of rallies. The pictures are very similar to the iconic pictures from the 1960s and 70s of students on campus holding giant signs and, doing sit-ins in the president office. So, it's very similar to that.
But as you have reported, and as I said earlier, only really a handful of colleges have divested of these stocks. What do you think the board's reluctance is about?
I think, one of the main arguments against divestments from people that I talk to is concern about the stability of the endowments. The endowments help fund faculty positions. It also is a major source of revenue for scholarships, and so they don't want to do anything that could put that endowment at risk. And so I think that's one of the major concerns.
And these fossil fuel stocks tend to be rather profitable. I mean, they give a good return to their investors.
They do, but there was the AP did an article back in May actually asking a research firm to look into whether or not that was actually true, whether or not that argument about, if these endowments divested, whether or not they would be worse off. And the research firm actually found that wasn't the case, and that if some of these endowments had divested from fossil fuels 10 years ago, some of them might even be in better shape than they are now.
And I don't know if you looked at all these various university portfolios, but do they have a lot of stock in fossil fuels? Is that a major portion of their portfolios?
It's hard because I think for a lot of colleges, they don't really know what's in their endowment because it's handled by outside groups. And so, some of the college presidents that I talked to really had no idea. But once they started looking into it, some of them realized that, oh, it's only 3% of our endowment. That's not that big of a deal. In terms of Harvard, that has a nearly $31 billion endowment, it might be a different case. I don't know, but I know Unity College in Maine, which is was one of the first to divest, had just a tiny slice in fossil fuels.
So it wasn't particularly painful for that particular university. But you wrote that a big test for this movement was Harvard University, and a majority of the students voted for divestment, but the board essentially said no.
Yes, I know. And it's the students have all the way up until graduation have met with Harvard trustees and members of the Harvard Cooperation Committee for Shareholder Responsibility, and they've had all these meetings, and but they're not budging, and it kind of seems as though Harvard is almost at this kind of standoff point. Now that it's the summer term, a lot of these kids are off campus, and so I think we're going to see a slight lull in college divestment movements for the next couple of months. But it'll be interesting to see what happens in August when everybody gets back.
When the students get back to school. I'm obviously not here speaking for the board of Harvard University, it seems like they were saying, look, there are other ways to address the problem of climate change, whether through education or research. They seem to be kind of pushing back on this divestment idea.
Yes, they do.
What's your interest in this movement?
I am just fascinated by kind of seeing this many people get behind and involved in a climate issue. For a long time, climate change has kind of been not in the forefront, especially it was a major issue in 2009 when they were discussing legislation in Washington. But after that, it kind of had a couple-year dip. And so it's fascinating to see kind of this grassroots almost kind of movement growing up again. So.
You mentioned drawing some inspiration from the anti-apartheid movement back in the 1980s, and I certainly remember that very well. And I think in many ways it was more the publicity about apartheid than it was about necessarily divestment. Do you think that might be true for this movement as well?
I think that might be true, yes. I think for a lot of people, divestment is one of the first opportunities that they've had to really think about climate change and getting involved in the issue, and I think it's bringing up a lot of issues. You know, for some people, this math, these numbers, are really kind of concrete ways to think about climate change and the issue and what we need to do in taking action.
Has there been, I know you've been covering this, but has there been a fair amount of press coverage? Because that oftentimes for a movement, for organizers, that's where you get a lot of push.
Mm-hmm. I think there's been local coverage, where these campaigns happen. I think we're seeing kind of local newspapers, and obviously there's a lot of coverage in campus papers. Mm-hmm. But we've also seen the movement spread beyond colleges and into religious organizations, and recently into a lot of cities. And so I think that's helping, that's kind of going beyond the college campus activity. It's helping to get the word out more on the topic.
And do you think once summer is over and the school year begins again that this movement, these organizers will get re-energized?
I think they will. I think that the students will get, a couple months of good sleep and come back and have kind of refreshed strategies.
And as you said, it's on maybe 300 campuses or some number like that. Do you see this spreading beyond those circle of campuses?
I do. Like I mentioned, we are seeing a lot of churches getting involved and divesting. And they don't have as big a endowments as universities, but this is very similar to what happened with in the 1980s with divestment from apartheid, and it started on college campuses, it spread to churches, and then it spread to local and state governments. And so this current divestment movement is following a very similar trajectory. So it's happening in a lot of churches now, and there's I think 14 cities that have promised to pursue divestment, including Seattle and San Francisco.
Which I think is probably not surprising, knowing some of the politics in those two cities. Well, Catherine Bagley, thank you for joining us today in Radio Times, getting our conversation started.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. She's a reporter for Inside Climate News, covers the intersection of environmental science and politics policy with an emphasis, as you could tell, on climate change. The first of three guests in this hour of Radio Times, we are talking about the fossil fuel divestment movement that began on a handful of college campuses, has spread across the country, about 300 campuses. And as she was telling us, some churches have gotten involved in this as well. We'd love to hear what you think about this divestment movement. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. And we have one of the activists waiting in the wings. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY Cornwall Manor, an active senior living community in Cornwall, Lebanon County. Situated on a 190-acre wooded campus, this community offers independence, wellness, and fitness activities, educational and musical programs, and the peace of mind of on-site healthcare if needed. Cornwall Manor's range of residential choices includes apartments and homes, including their newest options, the Carriage House and the Grove. Details and tour information online at cornwallmanor.org.
Coming to WHYY's Hamilton Public Media Commons, our popular Young Journalist Summer Camp for students in grades 9 through 12. Learn from the staff of WHYY's renowned news department, create video news stories, and work with the media instructors of the award-winning Hamilton Commons. Learn all aspects of production, interviewing, shooting and editing video, and more. Two-week sessions start June 24th and August 5th. RSVP at whyy.org/camps.
Vampires and superheroes have made Joss Whedon a king in Hollywood, but families harder to please.
It's an argument I've had with my stepfather over the years. He'd be like, when are you going to make a real grown-up picture without the vampires and those rocket ships? And I was like, never.
Joss Whedon's new movie is Shakespeare. No vampires, no rocket ships. That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're talking about a protest that has been gathering some momentum on college and university campuses. Students calling on their boards of directors to sell their institution's fossil fuel stock because of its link to climate change. The movement has drawn some inspiration from the anti-apartheid activism of the 1980s that also galvanized students. And today on Radio Times, is divestment an effective tool to reduce CO2 emissions? And we have some open lines at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. What do you think? Give us a call. Joining us now is Isabel Arthin, and she's a senior at Mount Holyoke College, an environmental studies major, founding member of MHC Divest. That's Mount Holyoke's divestment campaign. And right now she's working for 350.org as a summer fellow. And Isabel Arthin, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Glad to be here.
So why did you want to get involved in this movement?
Well, I've always been an advocate for the environment, but after reading Bill McKibben's article last summer, I was just hit with the fact that none of us can afford to have a wait and see approach anymore, that we have a responsibility to advocate for our futures.
Why, though, divestment? How do you see this as an effective tool to reduce fossil fuel dependence and CO2 emissions?
Right. I don't personally see the fossil fuel executives coming around and caring about our futures. I don't see them caring about my future, and I don't think that there's any reasonable way that we'll be able to combat climate change while we're still extracting fossil fuels and burning them and relying them as our primary resource. And so I think that without targeting that industry, there's no real way to fight climate change.
But how is divestment, how would that, I guess hurt would be the right word, how would that hurt some of these fuel companies?
Right. I mean, I think the main goal of the divestment campaign is to turn investments into a moral issue and a political decision. So if it's wrong to wreck the planet, like the fossil fuel industry is wrecking it, it's also wrong to profit from that. And so I think one of our goals is to isolate that industry in a similar way that that the tobacco industry was isolated, and show that it's dirty money when you're investing in the fossil fuel industry.
One of the sort of hard, cold realities of our economic system is that these universities can sell stocks, but other people are going to buy them. So it doesn't exactly hurt the companies.
Right, right. And I don't think that the main goal of our campaign is to actually financially hurt these companies because, I mean, honestly, like Catherine was saying, most universities don't actually even have a huge percentage of their endowment invested in these industries. It's more about turning this into an ethical issue and I mean, showing that these major institutions in the U.S. are making decisions to cut themselves off from that relationship with the industry and really just isolate them.
And what's been the response from Mount Holyoke College, where you're a senior?
At Mount Holyoke, we've had a generally supportive response from the administration. We're looking forward to talking with them more in the coming months in the fall. But we're just interested in supporting them and taking the next steps towards responsible investing.
So when you say positive response, have you sat down and talked with them? Have they expressed an interest in the campaign?
We've had conversations with our president, President Pascarella, and she's very supportive of environmental campaigns and has told us that she does believe that the college has should be invested responsibly. And so she's interested in working with us in the future.
Do you know what percentage of the portfolio is invested in fossil fuel stocks?
We don't know exactly at our campus. Our campus is similar to many other campuses and that our endowment is managed by an outside firm, like Catherine mentioned. Mm-hmm. So we still have a transparency issue that is going to be one of the first steps we need to address.
Well, let me get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We are talking about a fossil fuel divestment movement that began on some college campuses, has spread to other college campuses, to churches and some cities as well, as we heard from our first guest. And again, Isabel Arthin, our second of three guests in this hour of Radio Times, a senior at Mount Holyoke College, and she is a member of the MHC Divest. And again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Let's see what some of our callers have to say. It looks like we have Steve from Mount Laurel, New Jersey. Steve, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Point to make quickly.
Sure.
My observation is that if enough individuals and organizations divested themselves, it would ultimately put some pressure on the oil majors. But it's still fundamentally different than divestment in the 80s for South Africa and apartheid. And the difference is we all consume fossil fuel energy. And in the 80s, we didn't individually consume other than we didn't consume essential things, diamonds, uranium, rooibos tea. So I think ultimately it comes down to individuals and organizations markedly reducing their consumption of fossil fuels.
And you're saying, Steve, even beyond universities, which is obviously what we're talking about in this hour?
Yes, it has to be broader than just universities. What's the percentage of fossil fuels in this country consumed by universities? It's not great. And I think it comes to an individual and organizational level for reduction of electricity due to coal, of oil, and those things derived from those products.
Well, Steve, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Isabel, let me toss that to you. And it's true, you know, I drove to the train station this morning. I use fossil fuels to get to work.
Right, absolutely. And isn't it such a shame that we're all forced to have that lifestyle right now? I think it's a really good point. And I think that reducing our consumption is critical. I also think that it's not necessarily practical right now for many families and communities to do that, because alternative energy sources are not being given support through subsidies or otherwise, and so I think that in some ways it could be hypocritical to do one without the other. Like if I started a campaign on Mount Holyoke to go carbon neutral, I think that would be really great. Mm-hmm. But while our school was still investing our money in the fossil fuel industry, we're still supporting that industry. So I think they need to go side by side.
This was something that Catherine Bagley was talking about, our first guest, but looking at endowments, that's how colleges, universities pay their professors, provide scholarships, you know, run school programs and educate people like you to reduce the amount of that portfolio could have an impact on those very issues.
That's something that we hear a lot when we're organizing on campus. And the fact is, it's just not really true. A very small percentage of our endowments are actually invested in this industry. In 85, Mount Holyoke divested from apartheid and took out 17.2% of their endowment that had been invested there.
Mm-hmm.
This is probably talking like 4% or so. And the endowment takes market hits all the time and is able to absorb those. I think that what it comes down to is an ethical issue. If we're profiting from wrecking the planet, that's not where I want my money going.
Let me get some more callers in. Looks like we have Patrick from Princeton, New Jersey, joining us on Radio Times. And Patrick, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, it seems to me the thing to do is to buy the stock, cooperate with others who have the same goals and objectives, and actually affect the policies of the company. That selling the stock is a purely symbolic gesture. Whereas, even though it's 4% or so of each of these institutions, if you had enough of them, you could actually do something.
The idea of stockholders organizing and putting pressure on the companies, Patrick?
Yes, electing members of the board of directors, trying to actually affect the policy.
What do you think about that, Isabel?
Well, it's something that's brought up to us often from our administrations when they want an alternative to divesting. And it just does not have the same kind of weight that selling stocks do. And I think that somebody who has enough stock in a fossil fuel company to actually be able to influence their policy is not going to have an interest in watching that industry change its business plan completely.
But as I had said earlier, when you sell stock, someone else is going to buy it. It doesn't necessarily, you know, affect or hurt that company.
Well, that's true. If our campaign succeeds in isolating this industry, then the more and more people who are selling their stocks, I mean, it's just not going to be a very smart investment soon. I mean, our movement is growing, and it's not showing any signs of stopping. We're not stopping. We're not going to stop. And so I would say that right now the fossil fuel industry is not a smart investment.
How big is the movement? I know it's summertime, so it's probably a bit of a lull, but how big is the movement today, do you think, Isabel?
You know, you might be surprised. We're all really fired up about this, and there's a lot of action happening over the summer. So like Catherine said, there are over 350 campaigns now on college campuses, and that's just the student campaigns. And then you have all of the faith groups, and you have the community groups, and you have county-level divestment and state-level divestment, which is really exciting. And it's also, this campaign is part of a larger climate movement and part of a larger youth climate movement that's hundreds of thousands of people across the country. We're fighting things like the Keystone Pipeline, mountaintop removal, fracking. It's all connected, and we're all working together in this. So we've got a lot of power, and I'd bet on us.
Okay, fair enough. Patrick, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well. And again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Isabel, it's also part of this movement, and we're talking about university campuses. You attend Mount Holyoke College. Also to influence students there, potential, you know, future leaders of this country?
I think that is a great secondary goal. One of our main goals at Mount Holyoke actually is to build student power, and to get our campus active and to get people educated about these environmental issues that we're going to be facing more and more in the future, regardless of what we do. And so I think that's a crucial portion of our campaign is changing the mindset of youth in this country and of the public in general about climate change.
And what's the press coverage of this movement been like from your perspective?
I think it's been great. You know, it's always difficult to truly reflect the complexities of a movement. For instance, there's been a whole lot of focus on Bill McKibben, which is great. He's an incredible advocate for the climate and for the environment, and he'd be the first to say that he's not the leader of this movement. But I think often people need one person to focus on. But the truth is it's locally organized by student groups, the divestment campaign at least, or community groups off campus. And that just, it's such a rich diversity of people and such a decentralized leadership that I think is giving us more strength than we would have otherwise.
Have you considered have you and others at Mount Holyoke or even at other university campuses, have you considered things like, you know, boycotts, which have been used in the past when people are protesting against a particular product or organization?
We haven't considered that at Mount Holyoke. I'm not sure what we would boycott. It's incredibly difficult right now to boycott the fossil fuel industry, and I think that's one of the major problems is that we don't have feasible alternatives unless you're upper class and have that privilege that you're able to choose where your energy comes from. I think that boycotts are not necessarily the most appropriate tactic, but I could be wrong. It could be very successful in some areas.
Let me get to that. Looks like Dan from Cambridge, Massachusetts to join us. And Dan, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, hi,
Dan.
For having me on. Hi.
Hi there.
Hi, Dan.
Sounds like you two know each other.
We do indeed. Yeah, we around in Massachusetts. One thing that I just wanted to add, which I think we emphasize a lot at Tufts, is that this has sort of been brought up, but that divestment is primarily about building the political power to have climate legislation from the government, because what we've seen, what I really wanted to address with a question about active shareholder resolutions,
right,
is that it just hasn't worked. Like, over the past 10 years, you know, the climate movement has tried everything from buying the stocks and trying to work with companies to having lobbying on the inside to pass cap and trade. And what students are seeing now is that if we are able to build this pressure by having a symbolic move of divestment, that it can lead to climate legislation. So I think that that's like the most important thing that we hammer in. And to me, that's kind of why I stay motivated.
Dan, we don't have the greatest phone line, but I'm going to keep you on the air here since you're both involved in this movement. A handful of university boards have divested of these fossil fuel stocks that we have been talking about. Many have not yet. How do you propose, though, to use this movement to apply political pressure when you haven't seen the kind of board response that I'm sure that you both want? Isabel, you want to take that first?
Sure. I mean, it's been incredibly impressive to watch the youth of this country mobilize so strongly around an environmental issue. We're having huge rallies. We're building incredibly strong networks. And in the past two presidential elections, it's been very, very clear that the youth have a strong vote. And so I think that the more we can turn environmental issues into political wedge issues, the better position we'll be in to make better climate policy.
Dan, you want to weigh in on that as well? And you're a Tufts University, right?
Yeah, and I completely agree with what Isabel said. And I think history has only seen a few small schools divest so far, but at least at Tufts, we actually have an active committee of trustees, including he's on the investment committee, and students who are going to be working over the next few months to craft some different models for how we could divest. And I certainly anticipate that in the fall, there will be some larger schools who do divest. So I think that's one way we're building political pressure. Another is pivoting all the student enthusiasm on campus to off-campus projects. So this summer, myself and some other students at Tufts are working on state divestment and getting the state of Massachusetts to divest its fossil fuel holdings. And there was recently a bill introduced in the state legislature to make that happen. And also organizing rallies and even doing direct actions against fossil fuel infrastructure. Because we see this not as just an issue, but as sort of a planetary crisis, and that it's really like, if we don't get our act together as a society in the next several years around climate change, it's an irreversible problem. It's not a problem that can be fixed in 20 years. It has to be fixed now.
Well, Dan, I appreciate your call to Radio Times, involved in divestment at Tufts University. Isabel Arthin, thank you very much for joining us as well.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. She's a senior at Mount Holyoke College. And we have a third guest waiting in the wings and still have some open lines at 1-888-477-9499. We are talking about a student movement, a fossil fuel divestment movement on college and university campuses. Give us a call, 1-888-477-WHYY. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Moore College of Art and Design offers evening art and design studios for adults at their convenient Center City campus. Programs include jewelry and digital photography and certificates to help with career advancement in print and web design, fashion studies, and interior design. Registration is still available for the continuing education summer session beginning Monday, July 15th. Further details at moore.edu or 215-965-4030.
I'm John Hockenberry of The Takeaway. The Takeaway is a fast-paced look at the news of the day. It's in-the-moment conversations that take the facts and frame them in ways that make you think. Newsmakers, experts, and people affected by the news, all part of the conversation. The talk is better when there's more at stake. So listen to The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Beginning July 2nd at noon on WHYY.
The comic trio The Lonely Island has a new album, their third, with guest appearances by Lady Gaga and Justin Timberlake. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Andy Samberg and the guys behind The Lonely Island, who made music parodies on Saturday Night Live. Join us. I got that
diaper money. This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY. Man.
Jay for you. I got that white. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We're talking about a fossil-free campaign, a student movement that began a year or so ago, targeting university endowments, putting pressure on boards to divest oil, coal, and gas stocks because of the impact of CO2 on the climate. And joining us now is Mindy Lubber. She's president, founding board member of Ceres, also directs Ceres Investor Network of Climate Risk. That's a group of 100 institutional investors managing nearly $10 trillion and assets focusing on the business risks and opportunities of climate change. And Mindy Lubber, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Great to be here. Thanks.
You're welcome. And to our listeners, actually, looks like the lines have filled up at 1-888-477-9499. What do you make of this divestment campaign? Does it make sense to you?
Well, look, the bottom line is, for the investment community, if there's risk in the value of a company, companies need to address it and investors need to be aware of it. There are many ways to address risk. The divestment movement has been terrific at moving students into the debate on a worldwide problem where we all need to be engaged and involved. From an investor's perspective, some of them are going to divest, and I suspect some of the largest investors won't. But they need to be looking at that risk. Mm. And if they're not divesting, there are many other ways they can address it. As the owners of the largest fossil fuel companies, frankly, as owners of all the fossil fuel companies, they've got more clout and power to say to those fossil fuel companies, as your owner, as a major investor in you, we want you to start reducing your product in fossil fuels and start moving towards a renewable energy future, because that's where our economy needs to go. So for me and for many of the investors we work with, the question isn't only should we divest. The question is how, as investors who have clout and power with fossil fuel companies, could we have the most effective ability to make change? And we're seeing dozens of large investors engage with companies because their owners file shareholder resolutions where they cajole and try and move companies to change their practices. And any investor, whether it's divestment, whether it's engagement, needs to be looking at the very real and very clear financial risk to the bottom line of many of the fossil fuel companies, and frankly, all across our economy. If you think about the kind of storm damage and flood damage, what that does to every company in the economy. We've got to be mindful of climate change as a financial risk to our entire economy and certainly to the fossil fuel sector.
But it sounds that stockholders, whether they're universities or individuals, you have to figure out how to get organized in order to speak with the kind of clarity that you just did.
Yes, and no question, that's it. The reason why at Ceres, we run the Investor Network on Climate Risk. It's because it's 103 investors whose assets total $10 trillion who are saying, we see the financial risk in not having enough water, in too much carbon pollution, and we want to start addressing it because that's our job as fiduciaries. As some of the largest public pension funds, with assets of $280 billion here and $250 billion there, I mean, that's not decimal dust. They are looking at how to move the industry sectors to limit their carbon pollution, to bring down emissions, and to get the fossil fuel sector to start looking at their risk and to really take a long-term view at how to move out of fossil fuels, and that's not going to happen overnight, and into renewable energy, and how to get those very companies to support policies to change our carbon pollution problems at the national level.
I don't know how much college and universities, how much of their portfolio is invested in fossil fuels. It probably ranges from depending on what we are talking about or who we are talking about. But if it's a small percent, let's say it's 5%, and a university divests those stocks, does that really have a reverberation in the industry?
Well, look, one act of change is not going to change an industry overnight. And it's true. A university might sell their shares of stock in a fossil fuel company, and somebody is going to buy those shares of stock in a nanosecond, as long as it takes to execute the trade.
Right.
But it sends a signal that universities are concerned about it. When our investor network of some of the world's largest public pension funds say to a fossil fuel company, we want you to analyze the risk to the bottom line value of the company if half of the resources you have are never allowed to come out of the ground. Of half of the oil and gas that's underground right now that you value as part of the value of your company is never allowed to come out from under the ground, because if it does, it will put us in a so dire a situation as it relates to climate change that we won't be able to stop the problem. Well, then that's a risk that investors need to know about. And that's a risk that once the companies have to make public, our investors are calling on the largest fossil fuel companies to analyze that risk, to disclose it to their board of directors, and to disclose it to their investors. That's when the investors are going to be pushing the companies and working with them to change their business models, because in the end, a business model that is just about fossil fuels and carbon pollution is one that won't be able to exist over the long term.
Are there profitable companies worth investing in that are involved in renewable energy?
Unquestionably. There are more and more renewable energy companies coming into light. Wind power and solar power is doing better. We need to capture more of that market and not watch it go overseas, because that's where the jobs are. You can't export solar contractors who are putting solar panels on home. They've got to be here in the United States. The number of jobs in energy efficiency, in solar, in wind are huge. Those are crucial industries as we build the future. And it ought not to only be about the small companies. We know that the largest fossil fuel companies, whether it's ExxonMobil or Chevron or ConocoPhillips or Shell, they're not going away. They're part of our economy. They need to be moving their product base to be beyond fossil fuels. And that's where we're going to see a big jump in the amount of renewable energy that's made, that's used, that's manufactured, that's constructed, and that's part of our future economy. So it ought not to be only the small solar energy company. What investors are saying to the large fossil fuel companies right now, show us the risk from retaining only a fossil fuel product line. Show us the risk from keeping half of your reserves underground, which may very well happen.
Right.
And once you see that risk, you're going to realize you've got to start moving to other product lines. And that's the future. We've got to build an economy that can sustain itself and an environment and a planet that can sustain itself, rather than one where we're going to see $100+ billion loss from Hurricane Sandy alone in the Northeast, whether it was insurance company loss or government loss or individual loss. Those are the economics we can no longer afford. And to change that economic viewpoint, where we're spending $100 billion, as we did this year, from Hurricane Sandy and four of the other largest storms, that's an economic future we can't build. Moving out of the fossil fuel sector dominating our economy to a more diversified base of energy resources is how we build a long-term sustainable future, both for the planet, but very much so for the economy.
Well, I do want to get some more callers in on the conversation, but you mentioned the storms, and of course, New Jersey feeling the brunt of Sandy last year with storms and, of course, measurable sea level rise. But don't fossil fuel companies, they know this almost better than anybody else. If you've got a rig out in the middle of the Gulf of Mexico and you've got storms coming in, you're going to pay the price for those particular
Absolutely.
Storms.
And those are the risks that we're seeing grow. They're more severe. They're greater. They're affecting every segment of our economy. Look at the billions of dollar losses to the agricultural industry from storms and floods and droughts, frankly. Look what happened to the garment industry from the cotton crop dying from the droughts. Those are all tied back, or a good deal of those climatic changes, to climate change, and they're impacting every single sector of the economy, not just the insurance sector.
Well, we are talking about some of the pros and the cons, although it sounds like mostly pros of a fossil fuel divestment movement that began on some college and university campuses. Some churches have picked up, religious institutions have picked up the movement, and some cities as well. And again, Mindy Lubber, our third of three guests. She's the president and founding board member of Ceres, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get to Colin to join us from Kennett Square. Colin, go ahead. You're a Radio Times. Whoops. That would be Colin. Do we have Colin? No. Let's try Sarah. And Sarah is joining us from, it looks like, Malvern. We're kind of jumping around the phones here. Yes, yeah, Sarah, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty.
Sure.
Great topic, great show today. I just wanted to comment on the earlier discussion about the university students and the divestiture movement. And my son is a recent graduate. He was involved in the movement as an undergrad, and now this summer as a graduate, he continues to be involved and travels back to his university for meetings. So I don't see it slowing down during the summer, and I think that the students are really pushing our generation to make a change, and I appreciate what they're doing.
Well, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And Mindy, you want to weigh in on that?
Yes. Look, students have been charting the course for how to build a better future for hundreds of years, and seeing the students engaged in this discussion and watching it grow and build is terrific. One key point that I do want to make, though, is for those investors, for the large investors who choose not to divest, but to use the power of their shareholder value as owners of the companies to step in, to engage with companies on getting them to reduce their carbon footprint, to reduce their use of fossil fuels, is an equally as noble effort. Mm-hmm. And I've never seen change over the last 35 years as an advocate that doesn't take multiple tactics and strategies. Changing the world is tough stuff. Fossil fuels have driven our economy for decades and decades. It's not going to be easy. We need to use all strategies and tactics to, in a thoughtful way, in a comprehensive way, change the way we build our future and what kind of energy sources we use. And that's going to be hard. But for those investors who are asking fossil fuels to look at their risk, to do a stress test, to report back to their board and to the investors, as long as investors are engaging or using the fact that they own these companies to raise the issue of climate change, that's a good thing. Some may choose to divest, superb. Others may feel like divesting won't get what they want. They may choose to engage with companies. The most important point is whether you're a large pension fund or a large university, or frankly a small university, or you're you or me, where we have $5,000 or $10,000 in investment, to think about what we're invested in and to voice a very loud opinion about what's safe and what's not is our obligation. We ought to see it like we see voting.
Sarah, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Before we get back to our next caller, though, I'm curious, Mindy, whether even as an investor interested in climate change, is it important to make a distinction between gas stocks or oil stocks or coal stocks?
Well, we ought to look at where the risk is. The risk is from coal companies, they're from electric utilities, and they're from fossil fuel companies. Now, gas, natural gas is part of our short-term future. That's what's allowing us to back out some of the heavily coal, highly fossil fuel industries. But gas isn't a perfectly clean fuel, and we need to be mindful. If it's going to be part of our future, and it appears that it is, and it's cheaper, and many like it, we've got to make sure that it doesn't bring new problems. So from gas and fracking, of literally drilling and fracturing stone, comes water contamination. It is incumbent upon us as we bring out more natural gas, if that appears to be the case, to make sure that gas has regulations surrounding it so we don't have new water pollution and water pollution around aquifers. That is not an option to go from one problem to the next. The other problem is fracturing gas has also flaring of emissions that creates more climate problems, carbon pollution. We need to make sure that the problem of flaring is also prohibited as we go forward. So can't ignore it. It's there as a bridge fuel, but allowing gas to develop more and more traction in this country or anywhere, frankly, if it's going to contaminate the water, well, clearly there's no interest in trading one problem for another. We want to build a sustainable future that sustains the planet and our kids' future, and we want to build a future that's economically sound. And cleaning up thousands of waterways, if they can be cleaned up, which often is not possible, is not part of building a sustainable future.
Mindy, there's a caller who I'm going to steal his question. It has to do with he's, and I'm looking at my computer here, divestiture business is barking up the wrong tree. We need laws to tax fossil fuels. We have about 30 seconds before we have to say goodbye. Is he on to something?
So the answer is bingo. Tactics and strategies, there are multiple, but in the end, we need a price on carbon. We need a statute, a law that regulates everybody, and that is the most important thing, and we're working on that as well. In the meantime, there's a role for consumers, for investors. Investors, some of them engage, some invest, but in the end, we need to change the law that regulates carbon pollution. We need to send the right market signals. Carbon pollution has a cost, and we've got to put a price on it. You could call it a tax or anything else, but your caller is spot on, and I'm with him, and we're working for that every day of the year.
And Jim, thanks for calling in. I stole your question. Mindy Lubber, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Great. Thank you. Be well.
You're welcome. You be well as well. And she's the president, founding board member of Ceres. Emily Bryant produced this hour of Radio Times. Nick Sessler is our intern today. Kevin Griffin, our engineer. Radio Times is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, and Debbie Builder with assistance from Sophie Reed. Thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times. Appreciate those phone calls. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times for much more, including, I'm sure, a conversation on our Facebook page. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen.